time for Life Matters here on Radio National. Natasha Mitchell here with you. Terrific to have your company today. For the next hour, have you ever had a posh portrait photo taken of you and your family? Did you spruce yourself up for the occasion, comb your hair, scrub your face, get a good night's sleep to soften those dark circles under your eyes? One family of sorts is the star of a striking new photographic exhibition, but they may not have had a good night's sleep. Far from it, in fact. This family are the many people who find themselves sleeping rough on Sydney's streets. But in fact, these are joyous, artistic portraits. One of the subjects, Tony, and the curator is joining us shortly, plus episode 2 of Jane Caro's series, For Better For Worse, dissecting 6 long, long-lasting relationships. Today, it's the families we come from and how they affect the families we make. Look, first up today, beware of cat poo. A new appraisal on a potential public health threat few of us pay much, if any, attention to. Pregnant women usually know about this one, though. But it could be lying dormant in many, many more of us. And it might account for all sorts of interesting behaviours, from dangerous driving, slow reaction times, apparently. There's even conjecture about it worsening schizophrenia too, although that's more tenuous. One thing's for sure, this devious little parasite apparently makes mice lose their fear of cats. Toxoplasma gondii, or toxo, that's what it's called. US researchers have just reported in a review that the occurrence of toxo in the environment may be more widespread than previously thought. What does this mean for public health researchers? I'm joined now by Dr. Chris Tonkin. He's an Australian Research Council future fellow and a parasitologist with the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute of Medical Research. Part of his research is focused on the molecular mechanics of toxo. Welcome, Chris.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you, Natasha.
Let's not scaremonger here, but let's reacquaint ourselves with this parasite. This is one of the most common parasites in the world. What is it? And pronounce it for me. I've said it before on air in a program, but I always stuff it up.
That's right. It's a bit of a tongue twister. It's a Toxoplasma gondii, and we like to call it as toxo for short.
We'll stick with that.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a remarkably common parasite. In fact, it's probably one of the most successful parasites of humans. That is that about 30% of us are probably already infected with toxo. And it just lays dormant in our bodies and plays. There's no problem at all with it at all. But toxo is it's carried by cats. Well, the sexual cycle is carried by cats, and then the cats excrete that in their feces. So we can pick it up if those long-lived cyst forms that live in the cat's feces, if we contact them in some way. So, you know, for example, a sandpit that your kids are playing in, or you know, it's contaminating fruit or water or, you know, vegetables or some matter like that. So we can pick it up that way. We can also pick it up if another animal is infected with toxo and it has cysts lying in the meat, and we eat the meat that's undercooked or, you know, very rare.
And there's been some measures that its incidence in meat products might be much more than we would ever imagine.
It is, and we would never know, to tell you the truth. I mean, when we first get this parasite, it really just manifests as flu-like symptoms, and we think we've got the flu, and then we just get over it. Our body deals with it, and it just lays dormant in our bodies for the rest of our lives. And in most cases, in fact, the vast, vast majority of cases, it has no effect at all on us.
Well, that's interesting then. I'm wondering what we're worrying about. Although this recent US review points to particularly hugely increased cat ownership in America, at least, and possibly there's been a parallel increase here. And, you know, they nominate estimates of over 1.2 million tonnes of cat feces could be deposited into the environment annually. Their argument is that we might be underestimating the scale of our exposure to this parasite.
I think that that's possible, although I think that, you know, with greater measures of looking at, you know, when these studies are done, of course they find things that we're very surprised about. And so it's not really that surprising to me. It's such a successful parasite, and it's so ubiquitous that it's all these studies, I think, is doing is actually just telling us how common this parasite really is. And it's not that we're actually increasing at all in the amount of that we're exposed to this parasite. It's just saying how much really is out there in the environment.
So, Chris, most of us are carrying antibodies to this parasite, but who should be particularly worried about exposure to toxo?
Okay, so maybe what I'll do is first of all tell you a little bit about the parasite, which I forgot.
Yes,
to do
indeed.
Before.
I want to know about. Well, the life cycle is curious. You mentioned that it's in effect incubated in cats.
That's right. So basically, it's what the scientists like to the fancy word for is a unicellular obligate intracellular parasite, and that's just a fancy way of saying that it's a single cell, and it requires to live in other cells or in our cells to survive. So it gets inside and it has to proliferate inside our cells.
So it sort of co-opts at the cellular mechanics of our cells in order
to
function.
Well, it's not like a virus. It's a little bit different. It actually sort of eats our cells from the inside out. But it sounds very, you know, very gruesome when you say it like that.
Oh, it's just
but
biology.
What happens is, that's right. So what happens actually is that we have this acute stage, and that's what you get, the flu-like symptoms. And then our body takes over and the parasite somehow senses that it's being attacked. And it will then differentiate or change itself into a very slow-growing cyst form that then lodges in our muscle tissue and especially our brain. And that's where this whole area of behavioural change and behavioural modification comes with this parasite.
So we'll come to the behavioural story because that is absolutely intriguing.
Yes.
But pregnant women are more familiar with this parasite than the most of us.
Yes, that's right. So the people that generally have to, you know, are more at risk of getting disease associated with this parasite are when you're immunocompromised. That is, if you've had a transplant, you're taking immunosuppressive drugs, or if you're becoming pregnant. So, in the case of people that have had transplants, or in fact, if they've got HIV, then your immune system is suppressed, and therefore, if you do already have toxo in your body, then it can reactivate and cause problems. But we have really good treatments for this, and especially in our country, that it really poses very little problem at all. You present to your doctor and they'll give you some medicine for it. As for pregnant women, they need to be careful. They always say pregnant women stay away from cat poo or cats. And that's because if you pick it up the first time when you're pregnant, there's a possibility, and I say a possibility, it doesn't always happen, but it can transfer over to the fetus. And all usually happens in that case is that you get an abortion, or you can have problems associated with the congenital birth defects, such as epilepsy and mental retardation and, you know, developmental problems like that that can occur.
So women need to be careful as
they do.
Not paranoid, but careful.
No. It's important that we make sure that, you know, we've been living with this parasite since antiquity and it's generally been fine, and it's, you know, you do have to be a bit more careful, but it's not something that you need to be really diligent about, I'd say.
So in the critical phase of infection, we have a kind of flu-like symptom.
Yes.
But what's particularly interesting about this parasite is that it seems to co-opt or change the behaviour of its hosts in various ways.
That's right.
So tell us about the range of intriguing evidence there. In humans.
Yes, I mean, this is the really fascinating area of this
sure
of the biology of this parasite. And the fact that this parasite can change, or the evidence says that parasite can change the behaviour of its host. And that's quite a remarkable thing for a single-celled organism to do to a very complicated organism like ourselves. And that's what I find really fascinating and interesting. And so what happens is the first studies were done in mice. And so if you infect the mice with toxo and you let them have a chronic infection, that it will change their behaviour. And in that sense, so normally, if you put a mouse in a box, it will hug the side of the wall, a bit like if you see a mouse scampering, around your room, it'll scurry along the side, and it has an aversion to cat odor or cat urine. But if you infect them with toxo, it's much more likely to roam into open spaces, and it actually likes the smell, or it likes the smell of cat urine. Now, the idea behind that, people think, is that the parasite wants to change the behavior of the host that it's living in order to be transmitted again. So you can imagine that a mouse has a much better chance of being being eaten by a cat if it likes the cat smell of cat urine, or that it's roaming around in open spaces, and therefore it transfers, the cat will eat the mouse and the parasite will then go into the cat and then undergo its sexual cycle.
And it must get into the cat in order to reproduce.
Well, it doesn't have to, but that's one mechanism that, and I think that that's really prevalent, the cycle between cats and mice.
Mm. Well, I mean, that's one example of behavioural change, but in fact, researchers are now looking into all sorts of potential links between toxoplasmosis and schizophrenia, obsessive compulsive disorder, a range of mental illnesses. Just briefly explain that connection for us.
Yes, so again, these are all correlative studies. So of course, the scientists looking at the mouse behavioural studies think, well, what does this mean for human health? And so there's been correlative studies to say that people with schizophrenia are more likely to be infected with toxoplasma. People with OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, are more likely to be have antibodies to toxoplasma. Now, of course, this is just a correlation. This doesn't necessarily mean that the parasite is causing these mental health problems. It means it could be that the people with the mental health problems have a better chance of picking up this parasite for some way. But this link is very, very interesting, and it really deserves much more attention. And this is where our area, that these people that work on toxo are getting very interested in trying to work out the molecular mechanics of this.
Absolutely. And I'm looking forward to seeing where you take that pursuit as well. Just finally, do we have any idea, given this US review, any idea of how many people here in Australia might have toxo, or the degree of exposure here?
Look, I think we can only extrapolate, and anywhere in the world is 30 to 80% of people are infected in any population. I'd say we're on the lower end of that, so I'd say we're probably 30, maybe even 25%. But we've done studies even with people in our own lab just to monitor if they've been infected before, and usually about 1 in 4 of us is infected.
1 in 4. Well,
1 in 4.
Go on.
So I said, as I said, that we all live normally with these parasites there, but we have been exposed and we still carry them. So it's interesting.
Yeah, it sure is. And I don't know that we've quite nailed, should we be worried, but it doesn't sound like we should. They just sit there and do their thing.
Yeah, well, I think watch this space is a good term to use. I think let's see what really happens. I think that in terms of schizophrenia, it's not the causative agent of schizophrenia. It might contribute to the morbidity associated with it in some way, and that's yet to be seen. And that's an area of research that I'd want to get into in the near future.
Chris, we'll keep an eye on that. Thanks for joining us at the top of the show.
Thank you.
Dr. Chris Tonkin there. He is an Australian Research Council Future Fellow and a parasitologist with the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute of Medical Research. Interesting, isn't it? Who would have thought? Moggies, the carriers of all sorts of little beasts. And us too, of course. We coexist with zillions of bacteria in our bodies. Look, up next, a photo exhibition with a striking difference.
Listen, Wog, it's all your fault. Barges in here, marries me daughter, drinks me beer.
Next on Mongrel Nation, racism and aggressive nationalism.
We come here and we just get run over by Lebanese and Wogs and shit. It's not cool.
How racist is Australia? And does it threaten our multiculturalism?
People take a look at you, observe you from a distance, and then they start whispering.
I think she looked at me and thought, you're brown skin, you should be ashamed of that.
That's Mongrel Nation, Sunday at 5:30 here on RN.
You're doing it wrong, one of the catch cries of the age, and you could aim it at successive generations of newspaper management around the world. But there's hope in America that things are on the way up, if not all the way back. So what about here? Well, the papers say they get digital, that's the future, they're in the content business, but they're still in the distribution business too. We'll look at all that and get an insight into the madness of royal baby coverage in Britain on the Media Report. Download it from the Radio National website.
Have you experienced homelessness firsthand? Any of us could and do end up couch surfing for all sorts of reasons, or on the streets or in hostels, accessing soup kitchens. You know, the face of homelessness is no singular face, and certainly the rental crisis in Australia is contributing to that diversity, and it is a crisis. Let's be reminded of that. Portraying these many faces is the aim of a new photographic exhibition called Acknowledged: Portraits of Sydney's Homeless. And joining me now is the curator of the exhibition. She's head of photography and communications at Sydney Homeless Connect, Felicity Coonan. Welcome. And Tony Tuhoro is featured in the exhibition, one of the stars. Welcome, Tony.
Good morning, Natasha.
You really wanted to be part of this exhibition and to be a face, in effect, of homelessness, mm-hmm. and to go public about that experience. Why?
I think it was just inside of me. People know me anyway. They've known of me. I ended up on a TV show and music. I tried out for X Factor, and for whatever different reasons, I didn't make it. But I also brought up the fact that I was homeless. And there's a part of me that wants to bring something out of what I've gone through and try and influence others, and just to say, look, the face of homelessness, there's so many different people, but it's changing. It's not your typical bloke that's... with a brown paper bag. There's so many different variables.
Is it changing? Is that what you've witnessed in your experience on and off the streets? Because it's been a sort of process of cycling on and off the streets over years, hasn't it?
Yes. It is changing. I think it's getting better. I think certainly through Homeless Connect and crisis accommodation and the government itself at large, they're tackling the problem head on. But you're getting different groups of people now. You're getting family breakups. It's just totally different.
What triggered the experience for you? Where did it start, I guess?
I came here in 1980 from a broken family from New Zealand, and grew up in Australia around Australians. And, you know, I love Australia. I love Australians. They're my best mates. And so what you do, you get involved in... I grew up playing Aussie rules footy, and so what we did was win had beers, and then it ended up another cycle. And I turned it up and started getting into drugs. Fast forward through till 1996, it became something that was just something that I indulged in, became something heavier, and then I ended up on the streets.
Took you away from that kind of stable base of a home, and
well, my friends they just didn't know me anymore.
Yeah.
So they had to show me the mirror, and what it did was made me react and move away.
Well, for people who have not had that experience of not having a bed, a certain bed at the end of the day, how would you describe that experience?
When you first go on the streets, it's like your heart's broken. You never think that it's going to happen to you, and all of a sudden it's like there's no turning back. The first couple of weeks are definitely... you're debilitating on your self-esteem and your confidence. But having said that, within a couple of weeks, you sort of grow to get over it. But, yeah, even when you've been on the streets for a long time, there's a mask that you wear, and so you put on a face. You put on a face to say everything's all right when it's not.
Mm. And I sense that from people I've spoken to over the years that there is another community there. There's a community that gathers and meets, you know, at the places where you can get food. And so it's kind of a strange, in some strange way, it's another family.
You've hit it on the head, Natasha. It's actually, you get over the fact that you've hit the bottom rung of society, so to speak, and you find another community down there. There's a lot of other people from different cultures that have got there too. So you grow to understand, and you grow together, and you become a community.
Because that's sort of part of the impulse, the human impulse, isn't it, to kind of connect with other people.
Yep.
Speaking of connecting, Sydney Homeless Connect, Felicity, that's the project that has created this exhibition. So tell us about what sparked this exhibition, and perhaps you, in order to do that, you kind of had to explain this big, massive event that happens annually.
That's right.
So what is it?
Sydney Homeless Connect was started 4 years ago in Sydney by a couple of guys, Andrew Everingham and Pete Dury, and it is part of a wider worldwide phenomenon of Homeless Connect projects. And it started in San Francisco, and I believe there are a few in other places around Australia, Brisbane, Perth, Cairns, the Hunter. And there was nothing like that in Sydney. And the purpose of it is on one day to bring as many homeless people together with the services and goods that they need to help them on their journey out of homelessness. And it's not about talking about homelessness, it's not political, it's really about just outcomes on the day.
So what sort of services?
So we have homeless services, medical checks, we have legal services, We give them a great feed. There are clothes. There are, what else is there, Tony? It's a fantastic day. Both levels of the town hall. We're
great
given
photography.
And portrait photography. So it sounds counterintuitive, but
it's like a big festival almost, but with a really pragmatic, practical,
absolutely,
life nurturing.
That's
focus.
Right. It's about finding what we get every individual. We meet them and say, what can we do to help you move forward? So one of the things we thought that they may need is a photograph for a CV or a portfolio or for job hunting. And we set up a little makeshift studio in that first year with a wonderful photographer, Angela Pellizzari. And it just so happens that the photographs were fantastic and people were using them to send home to families to reconnect. One guy said, loved his photograph. We give them a glossy print and he asked for another one and said, I'd like to send this home to my family. And then he said, I'm going to go home to my family. It just gave him a way of reconnecting with them.
Because to write something down or to ring is sometimes just too much, isn't
it,
when
right.
there's been so much separation?
Absolutely. One guy this year asked me to email a photo to his mum and in Canada and said, just tell her I love her, just tell her I'm okay. And so usually they've had a great haircut, a new haircut at the day and maybe some new clothes. So they're feeling, people are feeling good. So in the second year, it became really popular. In the second year, we set up a second studio, just a little makeshift next door to each other. And we've photographed over 600 people in those four years.
Are we talking about massive queues for this photographic booth?
A nice, friendly, kind of jumbly queue. Yes.
I mean, these are, let's describe some of these images. Perhaps you could kind of pick some out in your mind and give, because this is radio. We've got to,
yes.
Because they are artistic, joyous.
They're stunning photographs. So Angela Pellizzari was joined by Jennifer Blau, and they've both been photographing the people there. In the exhibition, the photographs are stripped of colour. They're black and white. Mm. And they are really just however people would like to present themselves to us in the studio. That's really a photograph for them. So it's how they would like to present themselves. So there are groups, there are husband and wife pairings, there are...
Who are some of those groups? Who wants to be...
Sometimes there are mates off the street. We've had people come in and they've got their football jerseys on. We've got Wendell Saylor and a few people who come along and support us on the day and make an appearance and that's
He's
always
a good
popular.
Man,
yeah,
he's a very funny man.
Sometimes it's having a photo with their hero.
Tony, when you saw your photo, and you've probably had a few taken now... I mean, what's that process like of capturing an image of yourself, a visual image of yourself?
I can't stand the way I look, Natasha, but I know.
We
I
need
know.
To just explain, folks, he's a handsome bugger.
No. I know that part of my journey was self-esteem issues, and that's why I ended up homeless as well. That's why I did what I did. But I also know that whatever the photo is, it brings out the character of who I am. So I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying looking at the photos. I do like my photo. I'm getting better at it. I'm getting more confident.
What made a difference to you? Because at the moment you are living in a residence.
Well, I better. What made a difference to me was how I met Andrew and Fee and Peter and all the organisation of Homeless Connect was another bloke that's been on the street. Called Ken, who's like the doyen to a lot of homeless people. He influenced me to become a part of this. And at the same time, a lot of different things happened. So I took on the joy of actually being a part of these guys and spreading the word about homelessness and who we are. Mm. And I got supported accommodation through the government through a place called Nemoi, who take people off the streets. So things have really gone from one extreme to another. I've gone from being homeless to living in Potts Point. You know, so it's brilliant.
This is part of a particular local initiative, isn't it, to get people into private rentals?
Platform 70, yeah. And that's another test, I think, Natasha, because I think my neighbours are all going to work and working hard in these beautiful units, and I've got one next door to them, and it's been a blessing.
Yeah, so that transition's actually quite challenging, isn't it? Because it's more than
going through
a bed and a roof. It's actually adjusting to everything else.
Yes. And I'm learning to... relate to my neighbours because they're up and about and they're all working in the city. And I used to do it too. Like, I mean, I've held down jobs and been homeless, so that's the crazy thing about me. But it's been the new challenge of actually coming out. I'm growing in confidence, and it's through
not only through Fee and Andrew, who have done a lot in Homeless Connect, is through other people that are coming into my life and just being open. I think that's the thing that all these initiatives that are being started, it's actually starting to help people.
And Tony's part of Sydney Homeless Connect now, and that's one thing that we love is when somebody moves forward in their journey out of homelessness and then comes back to volunteer. Yeah. It's a lovely kind of closed loop.
Tony Tohoro, describe for us what that experience is like of holding out a job when you're homeless.
It was good. It was good. But the crazy thing, Natasha, is that you're going back home to the streets and it didn't make any sense. But at the same time, it was the way we did it. It was that, you know, living in the great outdoors, but you were still going to work. And I guess lately I had to stop all that because I wasn't doing with the money right. And I still fell over a little bit. And so people had to come and grab me again. So now I'm in a stage where I'm working on my issues, drug free. I've gone from one extreme to the other. I'm A1 strato. It's funny. You know, it's just funny, but I'm dealing. Actually, I'm not dealing. Everything's good. Life's good. I'm just trying to get out of that. And I think I'm not the only one.
Yeah.
There's a lot of us that are going, man, what's the next step? And we're so wanting to take the next step now. You know, life, and it's just finding that process and getting good people around me.
And that's the key, isn't it? That sounds like what this whole project has been about. And then actually portraying that kind of positive image as well of change through these portraits. Felicity, when you look at the national debate and discussion about homelessness and how to fix it, what comes to mind for you, given that you are at the coalface of connecting with people to help them survive homelessness?
Look, it's a really complex problem, and I think one of the things we've learned is that there are many, many journeys through homelessness. And it's. I don't think there's an easy fix, but I think if everybody finds something that they can do that they can, as we have, as storytellers, we've found a way that we can do something about this. I think through the exhibition we hope to inform people that there are lots of different stories. Tony's story is one case study, but there are many, many stories of families and young people and old people. Mm. And so we hope to just motivate people to realise that these are just like you and me, these people. They're not kind of, you know, they're not streeties. Streeties are only maybe 7 or 8%.
Streeties being?
The people who live rough, who live in the streets, like Tony has been for a while. A lot of people in short-term accommodation and shelters. Many, many women and children. In fact, 2/3 are women and children. Mm. And we show some of them at the exhibition. I must say what we also have at the exhibition is their stories. So we sat down with some volunteer writers, came along and listened to people and wrote down their stories. So the photos are accompanied by their stories. So we just would like to show people, you know, what some of the, who they are really as real people.
You mentioned, Tony, you auditioned for The X Factor. Music is a big part of your life. And in fact, I want to let people know that straight after this interview, you're heading into another studio and we're going to record a video with another one of your friends. And we're going to put that up on the Life Matters website.
Awesome.
But we want to play out with a song that, because music did actually keep you hooked back in to your heart, didn't it?
Yes.
Why this song?
And it's funny you say that because when I was going through, extremely around 99 to 2001, I was really heavily caught up in drugs. And this was the one song, even though I was living, I think the best way I can describe it is that when you've got an addiction and you're sitting down at Sydney Harbour on a beautiful day, and you can't get out of that cycle, or you seem you're going to die, you're just going to resign yourself to it. That song I used to have on my headphones, and it was going through my head, and I'd cry. But at the same time, I'd cry because I knew there was something better if I really chose to. And the song just says everything about how I was feeling. And I've got really good memories of that song. And every now and again, if I get a bit down, when we all do, that song comes back to me.
The Verve.
Yes.
Bittersweet Symphony.
Beautiful song.
Here it is, hey?
'Cause it's a bittersweet symphony. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We've all got tears in our eyes in the studio. Oh, Tony Tahoro, thank you very much for joining us and sharing some of your experiences with us today.
Cheers, Natasha.
And Felicity Coonan, curator of Acknowledged Portraits of Sydney's Homeless Exhibition. Thank you, congratulations. And I gather it runs at the New South Wales State Library in Sydney from the 27th of July, so that's this weekend.
That's correct, for 10 weeks.
Until the 6th of October. Yes. Get along, folks, please do. And we are going to be now videoing with you. Go and take a deep breath, Tony.
Okay.
Have a cup of tea and then pop into that studio and record a video, which we're going to publish on the ABC Radio National website.
Thanks, Natasha.
Thanks so much. Natasha.
Thank you very much.
Cheers. Thank you. Tony Tahoro and Felicity Coonan. Look, on Life Matters up next, Natasha Mitchell with you, by the way. We're going to be bringing you, for better for worse, our Super Thursday series on enduring relationships. Let's now re-meet our six couples. It's For Better, For Worse, our series each Thursday probing what it is that helps a relationship really sustain. Last week, we heard how they all first met, how many of them got married. There was the arranged marriage between Alex and Mariama, the shipboard romance between Kerry and Iggy, Michael and Gary, they've been together for 32 years. Then there was the on-again, off-again Bonnie, an Iranian refugee, and Mark, that blonde boy from Sydney's northern beaches. Anne and Dan, they met and got married in World War II. And Anthony, the fly-in, fly-out worker, met Rachel, that independent student in Perth through a mutual friend. Well, this week they're discussing not just the sort of family they hope to create together, but the family each of them left behind and how those two connect and relate to each other. For all of them, there were challenges negotiating the differences between the family they came from and the family they were trying to create, as series presenter Jane Caro discovered.
We're all a product of our past, and when you become a couple, you bring some of that past with you. Making the transition from your family of origin to life as a couple can take time. Kerry and Iggy had a very steep learning curve. After all, they'd only known each other for 10 days when they decided to get married after a shipboard romance.
I mean, I'd had a lot of therapy from my parents afterwards, after Kerry had gone back to Melbourne, to say, are you sure? What happened? You know, is she pregnant? All the questions that you can possibly ask. And I kind of went, no, she's just the right one. And she's the one that is for me and that I'm committed to spending the rest of my life with.
And how old were you? Kerry was 18. How old are you?
I was 23 at the time. Yeah, so still relatively young, but I just knew. I can't put my finger on it, but she was just the person who I knew I was going to spend the rest of my life with.
Kerry, did it take you a long time to introduce Iggy to your family? What was that like? Were you as convinced that this was the right man for you in the same way?
I was convinced after meeting him for 10 days. I just knew, call it a gut feeling, intuition. I just knew, because he talked about his family all the time in a loving way, not just, you know, to put it on. It was actually very genuine. I just knew, and introducing to my folks, not at all. We were quite laid back. Typical Australian family, very laid back and accepting. It was fine. It was absolutely fine.
What I did really appreciate about meeting Kerry's parents was her mother, who was lovely. Her mother I met and we got on really well, so much so that she actually, and I still have the letter, sent me a letter saying, just wanted to warn you about Kerry. Here are all her faults. She's stubborn. She's this. She's this. So it was kind of the letter to say, warning, please, you know, be ready for what you're going to get into by marrying this lady. So, yeah, I've still got that letter because it's just great, especially after all the time we've been together.
I love Mark's family, but the first few years, like I say, I would call and they would just pick up the phone and say, hi, this is Sarah's family. And I say, oh, hello, how are you? This is Bonnie. Can I speak to Mark? And they say, yep, I'll get Mark for you. There was no, whereas in our culture, you have to spend 15 minutes asking about everyone's mother, sister, if someone was sick, they'd ask them about that and how was their day, and then ask, can I speak to so-and-so, rather than just go straight into it. And so I used to feel really affronted. I used to think they don't like me, so I didn't want to stay over there a lot of times. Other times, well, I think I'm not always proud of the way a lot of Iranians dismissed Mark when we were in gatherings. At our wedding, they mistook him as a valet. Because we had two ceremonies. We had an Iranian ceremony and and the Anglo-Saxon ceremony. And in the Iranian ceremony, which is at my parents' house, I think he has been so invisible to them all this period. And while he was standing at the front to greet the guests, and you're not supposed to see the bride for a while, so I was upstairs. He came upstairs and he goes, I think they think I'm the valet. They're handing me their keys and jackets. I think that a lot of the men especially were surprised to find him sitting at the head of the we call it sofre, which is a table setting for the bride and groom, and that's where we sit to be wed, at the head of the table. But for me, because I live in this country, it was a little bit easier. But still in the family situation, or sometimes they would say things like, oh, you must feel really lucky because you're a woman in your country and you can do that. As if, I mean, Iran is in the Middle East, but we're not from the past century. There's still women do all sorts of things in Iran. And it is, in a progressive family, a woman and a husband and a man can be fairly equal sort of thing. But yeah, some of the comments that was offhanded comments was sometimes a little bit offensive to me. But it was all ironed out over time. It's me getting to know them and they getting to know me. As for Mark, his initial introduction to my family was rather eventful. You can describe that, my love.
That's probably an exaggeration. I mean, the first time I went there, I mean, the first dinner, it was a shock in itself because I had my first experience with Iranian food, and which I sometimes think I fell in love with her mum's cooking before I fell in love with Bonnie. I mean, when they'd served up this meal called horma sabzi, which I don't always pronounce properly, but and it's like this big stew of green stuff with lamb in it. But coming with a Western palate, it was quite intimidating, but I loved it straight away. So I sort of fell in love with the food and their family, and they were very welcoming to me. I got on very well with her father, which is always important, and you know, with Bonnie's mum, Nina. But I mean, they were a volatile family. It's a different thing. I come from my father comes from Russian background, and, you know, when you get angry and you go silent for 3 weeks and you stomp around the house and you don't talk to anyone. And that was my reality. There was never any shouting matches in our houses, ever. But they, you know, they're like, you know, a Hawaiian volcano. They just erupt constantly, so they're always venting. I mean, there were times there where
I would like to clarify, we were just talking.
There were nights when I couldn't leave because my bag was in the room where her parents were having an argument, and I didn't feel safe to go in there and get it. There were times when I would have to stand between her and her brother while I had an argument, or then go stand in front of Bonnie's car when she tried to roar off in a temper. So the way that they expressed themselves took a while to adjust to, but yeah, that was a bit of a shock to me.
So
So your family were rather worried about the whirlwind nature of the romance, or was there something else that made them a little bit concerned about your choice?
There was a couple of factors. I think the first was the whirlwind style of romance that it was. But I think the other factor as we got to know each other more was we are Spanish Catholic, and I was raised a Catholic and Kerry wasn't. So that was the other major concern that my parents had, because the Scarlet Woman was even more scarlet because she wasn't baptized in the Catholic Church. So there was a bit of angst, and there was a bit of... I'm probably saying this a bit lightly, but yeah, there was a bit of uncertainty about the future of the relationship because of the fact that Kerry wasn't a Catholic.
Michael's parents, and for that matter the rest of the family, are to be admired in the way that they've not just accepted Michael for his gayness, but myself as well. I mean, we are one big happy family. I can't sadly say the same for my own family. My mother struggles with the notion of gayness. I mean, she was brought up in a fairly strict non-Catholic household, and the notion of being gay is just something that she really doesn't want to ever discuss. She is very accepting of Michael in her own way, but she never, ever, ever says to me, "How's your partner going?" And my father would refer to Michael as "your mate. How's your mate going? You know, he's a good bloke." Dad was, you know, full of wonderful values, even though he had a drinking issue. And Mum has wonderful values as well. But sadly, and one would hope too, that before the end of her life, there might just be a window of opportunity where she can actually see herself to actually sit down with me and say, you know, it's okay.
I felt comfortable with Anthony from the start. Probably fairly early days for me that I took Anthony down to the farm to visit my parents. And and I was, you know, I was pretty tired, so I was having as much sleep in as I possibly could. And Anthony had just come off the mine site where he had to be in at work at 5 o'clock in the morning. And so he would be up keeping Mum company, chatting and doing all sorts of things, accepting numerous cups of tea and biscuits.
That's right.
And I realised just how easy Anthony fitted in. He wasn't trying to be anyone different, but he just slotted in so nicely. And it wasn't really a conscious decision of, oh, gee, he's the one. It was more a case of, I think my mum would have probably disowned me and adopted him if I'd made any other decision.
I wouldn't say I slotted in easily, because my background is more of a city boy, I suppose. I'm, you know, originally from Canberra and hadn't had much to do with farming or the, you know, the early starts and chasing cattle and goats and that sort of stuff. So for me, the first few times I went down to the farm and we stayed with Rachel's parents, I was a little bit out of my comfort zone, but I was also conscious of, you know, really trying to make an effort, I suppose, a good impression.
I didn't know that at all.
Well, no, it's more that maybe I was trying to be nonchalant and easygoing, but I sort of just wasn't familiar with the farming life, whereas you'd grown up with it. So, but certainly after having spent just one or two trips down there and I got to know Rachel's parents, I really understood that, you know, and maybe it's a cliche that if you really like somebody's parents and get on well with them, then it's a good chance that you're going to like that person as well. And I could tell from Rachel's parents that they were lovely people, and therefore there was a good chance that Rachel would be a lovely person too.
The biggest thing from them I got was that, and it's not a negative thing, is that they used to argue because they took notice of each other. I often see it in restaurants. You'll see a couple sitting there having dinner and they're not saying anything. And I think, what are they waiting for, somebody to turn on the television or something? But my parents, you know, they were always talking to each other about all manner of things.
In all honesty, we all like to think of our parents as being, you know, happily married and have led, you know, interesting lives. But sadly, in my parents' case, My father was a wonderful human being. He was a plumber. He unfortunately had a major drinking problem, which of course my mother found very difficult to deal with. And, you know, for most of her life, she was having to deal with this ongoing battle, which I think ultimately, you know, affected her tremendously, you know, not just in terms of, you know, her self-esteem, but more importantly, just her overall enjoyment of life. And I think she worked very hard as a result of that to be not just a mother, but a mother and a father, because Dad was away a lot. You know, he was working and drinking most of the day. We didn't see him till quite late at night. But look, having said that, he was a great provider and I loved him dearly. But, you know, it's hard sometimes to actually, you know, deal with those issues when you're growing up.
The real reason that we decided to, or I decided we would marry, was that I was going across to the, in the second front, into Europe, and there's no telling whether or not I'd come back or how. If we stayed, as we were, single, unattached, we lost out. But if we married then, before I went, she would get the army soldier's allowance. If anything happened to me, injured or killed or anything like that, she would get more. So I thought it was a very good idea to do this. And I put it to her mother, and her mother entirely agreed with me. So we persuaded Anne to marry. I don't think she knew quite what it was all about.
Anyway, we're here. We're still together. But it hasn't always been easy.
For a couple of hours till dreams come true. As to the number of kisses, it's up to you. Moonlight cocktails need a few.
Anne and Dan, who met when Anne was just 15 and married in London during the Second World War, were brought up in a different world. So different, in fact, that when Dan tells us his full story, it's the first time Anne has heard it.
My mother died when I was very young. My father eventually went off with another woman. And my sister and I were fostered out. She was slightly older than me. The reason for this was that we had lots of aunts and uncles on both sides of the family, but my mother had expressed a wish that we never be parted. And then none of them would take both. So we were fostered out and we had a rough time. And we finished up with a very, what shall I say, they seemed to me old, they wouldn't have been so old then, pair of drunks. They used to both drink. She drank Australian red wine off the barrel. And the old man, her husband, he used to drink what they called four ale. This was a pint of ale for fourpence. When they came home, frequently slightly inebriated, then one or other, my sister or I, would be in trouble. We'd get physically knocked about. In the house where we lived, there was no bath. We had a galvanised thing in what we called the scullery, mm-hmm. and we washed in there. The place was full of spiders. It was dreadful. Mm. It was a really, really bad upbringing because the mother and father, as we called them, mum and dad, they were sort of semi-literate, semi-drunk, and they shouldn't have, in my opinion, looking back on it, should never have had the responsibility of raising children. But they did it for the money.
That's a hard background to come from, yes. And have a successful relationship.
Yeah, my mother never drank at all, did she?
So you came from, you say, quite a united family. For you, it was much harder.
Those was happy. Yeah. They were very poor, but very happy. Mm. And the kids didn't even know they were poor. They lived their life. Everybody on that estate, they were in similar circumstances. The kids all played together. They were all quite happy.
So your mother was quite supportive by the sound of it when you wanted to marry?
Anne's mother. Yeah, Anne's very, mother. Very supportive, yeah.
Did you
She was a wonderful lady, and nobody at the time gave her credit for the wonderful person she was.
Yeah, but you grow up and you mature, then you start evaluating. You know, we had no idea. My mother was a widow with five kids, and it was a really hard struggle. I mean, I was very naive. It never occurred to me to evaluate where we lived. Or,
as she said, she was naive. She was extremely naive.
Alex and Mariama had an arranged marriage, and no sooner had they wed than Alex's work took them thousands of miles away across India.
And what was it like having your first child away from your family with a husband you didn't know very well? What was that like?
The custom is that usually for childbirth we went to our parents' home, and we are there at least for 3 months, and we always had help, maids, to look after the baby and the mother.
Did you go with Mariama to her parents, or did you stay in and keep working while she was at her parents' place waiting the birth of your child?
Well, I remember we went in April to her folks, and I left her there with her parents, and I came back to Bombay to work. Our elder son was born in July, so May, June, July, so 3 months before birth. And then I stayed on working in Bombay till October. I saw our first son only when he was 3 months old, because I just couldn't get leave before that. I was upset about it, but that was the way things were, you know, and I just couldn't leave, you know.
That may have been the way things were, but as we will discover next week, they're not the way things will stay. Not for Alex and Mariama, or for any of our couples. Next week in For Better, For Worse, we enter stormy waters.
Jane Caro there with episode 2, For Better, For Worse. And thank you, big thank you to our 6 couples for really cleaving open the story of their relationships. Next week they're going to give us some rather tense stories, so we are grateful for them sharing those with us. The producer for this series is Amanda Armstrong from Radio National, and the sound engineer this week was Mark Don. And I want to let you know there's a feature website for this series too, with photos of all the couples then and now, and also audio of each episode going up there too. I want to squeeze in a quick call that we got from our Big Moves talkback last Friday. Here's Daniel.
Oh, yeah, my name is Daniel. I originally left Brazil about 11 years ago, just on a, 3-month program to learn English in Ireland. I've lived in Ireland for about 15 months, ended up moving to Amsterdam, then to the UK, where I lived for about 3 years. Met my wife, who's an Aussie, ended up coming to Australia, been here for about 6.5 years. Yeah, it's been great so far, and, I'm definitely staying here. So, I love it.
I was really struck by some of your incredible stories of risk and courage and really delightful. Big moves in your life that inspired us all in the Life Matters team, I think. And I'll tell you about our talkback tomorrow in just a tick. But I want to come to Michael Cathcart from Books and Arts Daily. Hi.
Good morning, good morning, good morning.
Hello there. What's up?
Book theft. We've got to talk about book theft. It turns out that America's got quite a history of people pinching books from libraries and then flogging them to the highest bidder. Yeah. And Travis McDade is sitting right in front of me here in the studio. He's from the University of Illinois, and he's an expert on all of this. Lots of skullduggery in the library. And we're going to look at the Helpman Awards there on Monday, the big glittering night. So we're just going to preview who's up for a Helpman.
Yeah, good one. Thank you. And I noticed the Man Booker shortlist was out this week too, on the day of the baby's birth, I think.
I know. It's all happening at once.
Thanks, Michael. Who floats your boat when you vote? That's our talkback next on Life Matters. Join us after the 9 o'clock news on Friday. Coming up to the news now. It's 10 a.m.
Not too many political philosophers end up as an iTunes phenomenon or a YouTube sensation, unless they're Michael Sandel. And it's no wonder. The latest book by this Harvard professor argues there are some things money can't buy. There's virtue in everyone waiting on the same line. It cuts the snooty down to size. It reminds us of the common good. Download or stream this episode of the Religion and Ethics Report from the RN website.